This is KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and you're listening to our Healthful Living radio show, where every Thursday we serve up a palatable taste of the truth. And today I have two wonderful guests with me. I have Sandrine Hahn, who serves as has served in the capacity of marriage, family therapist, art therapist, teacher, and most recently a learning specialist in private practice. She's the founder of the San Francisco chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation and served as a volunteer chapter leader for more than a year. She is also the president of the Nourishing Our Children campaign, which is a nonprofit campaign of the Weston A. Price San Francisco chapter. Whew, that's a mouthful. And we have Jessica Prentice with us, and she is a professional chef, food activist, and founder of Wise Foodways. She is the co-founder of Locavores and the Eat Local Challenge, and they are both here today because they're both on the board of directors for a campaign called Nourishing Our Children, which we will go into in great detail, but it is the timeless principles for supporting learning, behavior, and health through optimum nutrition for our children. And we're going to talk all about that today. And Jessica also has her own book out and uses some of these principles as well as a whole variety of wonderful other threads of knowledge and wisdom. So we're going to talk to her as well. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
It's great to be here today and have you both on with me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Sure. So first I thought, since although Jessica's book is not specifically about Weston A. Price principles, we'll probably be mentioning it throughout this, so I thought it would make most sense if we could both, if we could all spend some time talking about who is this Weston A. Price person and why is it going to be something we're going to be talking about for an hour, and then we can kind of break into the different components. So I don't know who might want to share this, but
I like Jessica's spiel.
Okay. So, Jessica, do you want to give a small overview on Weston A. Price and who he was? And
yeah, I'd be happy to. So, Weston Price was a dentist in Cleveland, Ohio, who in the he was practicing in the early part of this century. And in the 1920s in particular, he was noticing a few disturbing trends. In his practice, he was seeing a sharp increase in the number of kids coming in with dental cavities. He was filling more and more cavities, but also he was noticing what he was calling dental deformities, which is simply what we would call crooked teeth or crowding in the mouth. And he was correlating this also to those same patients having general overall poor health and the fact that he was seeing in the society a stark increase in degenerative diseases, which everybody was sort of commenting about and trying to figure out where these diseases were coming from that are now commonplace to us, but cancer, heart disease, diabetes, all of these were on the rise. At the time that he was sort of wondering what was going on because he was seeing these things in his practice, another thing was happening, which was there were sort of rumors coming in from people who were traveling around the world and making, you know, kind of quote-unquote first contact or early contact with isolated traditional peoples throughout the world. And one of the things that, one of the rumors that was being said about these people was that they had perfect teeth. And he was very intrigued by this because he was seeing all these dental problems in his own practice. And he decided to put some energy into it and find out if it was true. Are there isolated traditional people out there with quote-unquote perfect teeth? And if so, what are they doing differently from us? And he was particularly curious about the nutrition because he was really convinced that nutrition was a key factor in all of this. And he spent over a decade traveling to very isolated, remote parts of the world. And he indeed found whole villages of people with what he considered perfect teeth, which meant they didn't have any tooth decay, they didn't have any crowding, they had room for all of their teeth, including their wisdom teeth. So perfect teeth meant you had 32 of your teeth were in your mouth, and none of them were decaying, and they were all lined up straight. And which is something that's almost, if you ask a crowd of people nowadays, if anybody has all 32 of their teeth, no cavities and no crowding, You might be lucky if you get one hand raised.
And they didn't brush their teeth nor floss nor have dentists.
They didn't. Yeah, they didn't have dentists. They didn't have dental hygiene, and yet they had these perfect teeth. So he did something very key also, which was that the main, you know, remember this is the 1920s and 1930s, and there was a lot of talk at this time around genetics. And, of course, this was, you know, before Hitler and all of that. And the kind of prevailing theory at the time was that whether you had straight teeth or crooked teeth had to do with your genes. And so what he did when he went to these traditional communities was he documented the teeth in the village, but then he also sought to find that same ethnic group in a situation which they had changed their diet to our modern diet, or to what he called the displacing foods of modern commerce. And he would, maybe it was people who'd moved to the city. In many cases, it was people who'd been moved to a reservation or moved on to a mission. And what he found was that the people in that same ethnic group, immediately that when their diet changed, they started to suffer the same problems he had seen in his practice in Cleveland, which was the tooth decay, the crowding of the teeth. The next generation of kids had overbites, underbites, not enough room for all of their teeth. All of the things he'd seen in his practice happened within a decade or so of changing the diet. So he was really convinced that this was a nurture, not a nature issue.
Mm. And I just wanted to add that actually he discovered that within one family, like the you know, the parents would have these amazing teeth, you know, like piano keys, he would say. And then if the children were fed, just in one generation even, if the next generation, if the children were fed the displacing foods of modern commerce, the white flour, the sugar, the denatured processed foods, their mouths were already showing evidence, and not only their mouths, but their faces. Their entire the structure of the face was becoming narrower, and therefore not in a position to carry all those teeth.
And then the second generation,
right, further and further physical degeneration was occurring as they continued on this modern diet.
And another important aspect, a lot of people think, well, this is just about teeth, really. You know, who cares about teeth? We can get them fixed. It's
right.
Not that big of a deal. But, you know, there's a lot of folk wisdom around looking in the mouth and looking at the teeth as being a indicator of what's going on inside the body. And he also asked lots of questions in those villages about what people died of and how old they were when they died. And, you know, one thing that I hear a lot is people think, oh, you know, we live so long in this country.
Yes.
That's why we have cancer. That's why we have all these problems. But that is in comparison to the industrialized peoples that, you know, mainly European, that we have records about. But in these isolated traditional places, the people were very healthy, very hardy, and they were long-lived. And he also was very interested in the women, how easily the women got pregnant, what was sort of the communal knowledge about what you did to increase fertility, what you ate when you were pregnant, what you fed yourself and your baby when you were breastfeeding. All of that was important, and he was curious, you know, how hard is it for the women to give birth? Because he was starting to see one of the things that was starting to happen in America was that it was becoming harder and harder to give birth. And he actually correlated the facial structure and the width of the palate to the width of the pelvis, and that when the face was getting narrower and there weren't room for all of the teeth, that this generally indicated also that the pelvis was getting narrower and that the mothers would have a harder time giving birth. And he found villages where, you know, those things that we now think are sort of apocryphal of, you know, the woman goes into the hut, oh, you know, it's time, and she goes into the hut, and, you know, a couple hours later, the baby's born, you know, relatively pain-free. And he's like, no, that really happened. And so he was interested in looking at the overall health in the village, and he was a dentist, and the teeth were, for him, a window into a much larger issue. It wasn't just about, you know, braces or flossing.
Aesthetics and all of that.
Yep.
That's a great overview. And so some of the things that he found in these villages is that they had some common dietary or nutritional things in common, right? So the healthy generations didn't eat any processed foods. They ate a lot of fat and really revered these fats, butter, fat, and liver and saturated fats. And he learned, or he really discovered, that it was some of the nutrients, the vitamin A and vitamin D in those, that helped with so many things in the body. So it was the fat itself and the nutrients that came in with the fat that just increased overall health. We'll talk a little bit more about that. What else did he do? Most traditional cultures eat fermented foods.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other things I'm trying
to... I think it's important just to point out that the diets of these people were extremely diverse. They were... Each group ate the diet that was local to where they lived. But what is amazing to me when you think about it is that, I mean he studied Inuit people in Alaska. He studied Swiss villagers in the Alps. He studied Gaelic islanders off the coast of Scotland. He studied East African peoples. He went to Australia and studied the Aboriginal people, the Maori people of New Zealand, Fiji Islanders, Andean indigenous people.
Wow.
And all of these people from all of these far-flung corners of the earth had independently all found certain common denominators that they understood kept people healthy. And so even though their foodstuffs might have been very different, there are some basic common denominators that are sort of, you know, what I consider the nutritional wisdom of our ancestors, like what people all around the world figured out when they lived, you know, in an environment where they were really paying attention generation after generation to what kept them healthy.
Mm.
And many of those things are exactly what you've described. They all valued fats. I think the percentage of calories that came from fats ranged from 30% to 80%, depending
wow.
on where on earth you were living. But none of those were a low-fat diet. And so they all knew that fats were important. They all used the entire animal. If they ate meat, which many of them did, they valued the bones and the fats. There were no boneless, skinless chicken breasts in any of these cultures. The whole animal and the organ meats were very, very important. If they ate grains, they soaked them in a acid environment for a period of time before they ate them. If they ate milk, they ate it raw and generally cultured as well. So it's pretty amazing that they're, you know, these far-flung people had certain wisdom that was universal, really, human wisdom.
It is amazing.
And the other thing is that what they ate and then what they didn't eat, none of these groups, not a single one of these groups, ate any processed, refined, you know, sort of canned, packaged convenience foods.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing in their diet that was similar to the food that we see in the shelves of our supermarkets.
Mm-hmm.
And they also didn't eat even foods that we commonly consider healthy in our society today, such as soy. Any of these kind of man-made foods
mm-hmm.
were just not present at all in their diets. The food came as close to the way it, you know, was. In other words, there were whole foods that were as close to the way they were created, grown, as possible.
Mm-hmm. And they were processed, but they were traditionally processed. They were
right.
processed with a huge amount of wisdom mm-hmm. in terms of what in a grain, for example, if you treat a grain as a seed, which in nature it is, then you process it in a particular way that all of the cultures that ate grains did. And when we talk about processed foods in our country, what we're really talking about is factory processed
yes.
foods.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't eat, you know, anything like that. And of course, people say, well, they didn't have anything like that. But it's amazing the amount of wisdom that they put into the way that they did approach their foods from the how they raised, how they harvested, to how they processed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very intentional. It wasn't just sort of survival.
Mm-hmm.
It was intentional.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us to your book, which talks a lot about that, the importance of using food to nurture and to see it as a gift and all of those wonderful things. And your book is called Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. And again, that's Jessica Prentice, for those of you who just joined us. And so tell us a little bit about your book. I know there's several overriding sort of themes or threads throughout the book. One's your personal story.
Mm-hmm.
One's the nutritional aspect of Weston A. Price.
Mm-hmm.
One is the spiritual aspect of the connection to food. And the other is the ecological need to be able to sustain this food supply for many generations. So I'm not sure, where do you want to start in just kind of giving people a general overview of your book? And
well, maybe I should just tell a little bit about my story with food, because that's was sort of the personal basis for where the book came out. I've always been very interested in food, going back to my childhood, and was, you know, a typical American kid who ate a fairly typical American diet. But I did love bacon, and I lived in Wisconsin when I was really little and loved liverwurst and foods like that. But when I hit adolescence, I went to a sort of hip private school in Washington, D.C., which is where I grew up, and an older student convinced me that eating meat was wrong for all of the reasons that we're all so familiar with. Of course, the inhumane treatment of animals, but also the fact that, you know, we couldn't feed the world on animal foods, but we could on grain foods, and you know, just sort of all of the progressive political social reasons that that influence people to become vegetarians. Mm-hmm. She introduced me to all of those, and I was all for it. I wanted food to be something spiritual. Even then, I was 14, and so I became a vegetarian and just became increasingly strict. I also sort of came across some of those, you know, I started to worry about my body, as I think many teenage girls do, and thought I was, you know, too heavy, mm-hmm. and so I put myself on the Pritikin diet, I know, for a while, which was absolutely no fat, no sugar, no salt, and I stayed on it for as long as I could, but I was just, you know, I was practically eating my fingers, I was so hungry, but I thought that that was the best thing to do. I, you know, even when I went back to my suburban high school, I kept this commitment to vegetarianism and to eating as what I considered as nutritiously as possible. Mm-hmm. And I tell the story in the book of, you know, every day I would take a whole wheat pita bread in the morning and pack it full of chopped vegetables and sprouts, and that's what I would take to school as my lunch, which I thought was very healthy, but I would eat it, and I would still be just be ravenous. Mm. So I stayed on that vegetarian diet all through college, and actually throughout college I was in pretty poor health. I had just a series of, you know, glandular infections and had to go on antibiotics over and over again. And by my senior year I actually had this rampant, terrible outbreak of eczema that was covering my whole body. And of course the doctor said, well, hydrocortisone, you know, and you're probably going to be on hydrocortisone for the rest of your life, kind of thing. And so at that point I started seeing acupuncturists and did start to get healthier. I was also looking at food as part of my healing process, but was very influenced by, you know, macrobiotics and the vegan movement. And so I kept, you know, I tried to eat lots of seaweed and still eat very little fat and still didn't eat any meat. And, but unfortunately for all of my intense intent on food and what I was eating and nutrition, my health just continued to decline, and by the time I was 27, I had a large cyst that I had to have surgery to have removed, and I was still seeing acupuncturists, and they were really encouraging me actually to start eating meat, and I kind of just said, enough is enough. You know, whatever it is, it's not worth this level of suffering, mm-hmm. and even though I was very identified with being a vegetarian, it was very much a part of my identity, I did start eating meat again. And I remember that the first thing I had actually was a steak, and it was just this amazing feeling to eat it, like I was being nourished in a way that I hadn't for a long time. I went to cooking school, at a vegan cooking school, but I was already eating meat at that time, and it was very interesting to me that most of the teachers at that school were ex-vegetarians. They had been through, you know, a serious commitment to vegetarianism, but for one reason or another had sort of changed their minds, and I thought that was telling. And then I came back and got a full-time job as a chef, and it was while I was working as a chef that I heard an interview on the radio with Sally Fallon, who is the founder of the Weston A. Price Foundation, and she was explaining these traditions and these principles, and it just, everything all of a sudden just clicked for me. Mm-hmm. Everything that I had experienced in my body, the whole struggle that I had, all of a sudden became clear and made sense once I understood that, you know, people for generations had had this wisdom and that I hadn't known about it. Mm-hmm. And I all of a sudden understood why that, you know, that dry pita sandwich all those years had not been satisfying me, and why I didn't do well on a, you know, a strictly vegetarian, almost vegan diet for so long. And so now I've really embraced these principles. And in fact, to me, they now bring me much more into harmony with our ecology. Mm-hmm. I think there's a huge amount of wisdom there, and it actually has brought me back. I mean, even things like having to, you know, deal with a whole chicken and pull out the organs and, you know, take the liver and make pate and take mm-hmm. the feet or the head and make broth, all of these things have brought me into a deeper relationship to the earth mm-hmm. and to the foods that I eat, whereas vegetarianism ultimately sort of took me away from that.
It's interesting because I think we were all vegetarian in this group at one time. I was as well. And the things that you talked about at the beginning, the reason people don't want to eat meat, that it's inhumane, the way that they're raised, that how unhealthy they are, how unhealthy that is for us, that's all true when you're talking commercially raised animals. But then you start looking into the ecology piece and you see, but it doesn't have to be that way. And so you can still eat meat and not support any of those principles that we find so repulsive. Mm-hmm. We can have cows that are really sacred and taken really well care of, and they live a nice, happy life, and it's a reciprocal relationship, and it brings a whole new option to people that chose vegetarianism for other reasons, that now might be deciding, for myself as well, it wasn't working for me, but then I learned, I can do it healthfully. And so that's why I think this ecological piece really comes into play. So I'd love to hear a little bit from you about sustainable agriculture and why that's so important.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, the whole argument that we can't feed the world on meat products is based on the fact that we feed our animals grain and that grain should be going to people instead. But in the Weston Price Foundation, we sort of look at that and say, well, we actually shouldn't be feeding our animals so much grain. In fact, cattle and other ruminants shouldn't be on grain at all. They should be on pasture. And there's large parts of this planet that are not suitable for growing grain that are suitable for pasture. And those are the traditional people that were pastoralists, that were dairying people, was people who lived, near the Himalaya, in the Himalayas or in the Alps or in places that are much too steep for that kind of intensive agriculture. And that those landscapes are ideally suited to pasture land. The Great Plains also are ideally suited to pasture land. And so, the whole environmental piece is interesting in the sense that when we look at feedlot agriculture with our animals, this is obviously terrible for the animals. We all know that. The animals are crowded. They're sick. They have to be on antibiotics and hormones. It's terrible in turn for the people who eat the foods that come from those animals. Not only are they getting those hormones and antibiotics in their food system, but also they're eating sick animals, essentially. And that's not a good thing. But what we've learned, or what I've learned at least most recently, is that that's also a terrible scenario for the planet on a lot of levels. The methane gases that are created when you have animals in that close confinement are a big carbon problem in terms of the atmosphere, whereas if you have animals out on pasture, their manure is actually a benefit because it gets broken down and fertilizes the ground and is part of a whole cycle. It's just a matter of being in balance. You know, manure was a very good thing until all of a sudden you had it in very, very close quarters and too much of it. Mm-hmm. So what I find so fascinating is that the more you learn about this, the more you realize that certain things work on every level. The things that are really best, you know, what's really best for the cow is also actually what's really best for people, and it's actually what's really best for the planet and for our ecosystems. And so, unfortunately, with industrial agriculture, we shifted our model, and you know, it's all based on how to use all these poisons that we developed for World War II and grow lots of food, more and more and more food, a lot of which was grain. And now we have a glut of grain. We have too much grain, and you know, we have all these ways of sort of pawning it off, getting rid of it, including feeding it to cattle. In any kind of healthy ecosystem or financial system, it is more economic to feed cows grass, which we cannot eat, than it is to feed them grain. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you subsidize grain and grain becomes cheaper than grass, then that whole thing gets thrown off. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's actually cheaper to feed them grain, and then to feed them grain efficiently, you have to put them inside. And then once you put them inside, then, you know, the nutrients in there, in whatever they produce, goes way down because they're not eating, their appropriate diet. They're not getting access to sunlight and fresh air and all of that. And, of course, the animals suffer, which I think is a burden that we all carry living in this culture, and just knowing that there's feedlots out there with suffering animals.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And like you said, I think cultures have realized for many generations that if they wanted the next generation to survive, they had to take good care of the resources they had, the land that they had. They couldn't just deplete the soil. They couldn't take poor care of their animals, or they were going to get inferior quality and they were going to be sick. And so you're exactly right. It's seeing that what is good for one is good for all. So if it's good for us and it's healthy for us, it's healthy for the animal, it's healthy for the planet. So we don't have to choose. The only reason we start having to choose is if greed and money gets in the way, and then we want to produce it as cheaply and as profitably as possible. And we have gotten very spoiled. We have in America, we have the cheapest food or at least one of the cheapest foods in the world. And so we have all this quantity of nutritionless food.
Right.
So,
And I just want to say one other thing that I think that, you know, there are some cases, I would like to say that it's all a win-win on every level. There are, the other factor that's coming in here is overpopulation. And so I do think that that there are some issues around how to have enough of everything for people. And, you know, traditional peoples, hunter-gatherer peoples, were able to use, for example, the eggs of migrating birds as a major food source, and very, very nutrient dense. They would go foraging for those eggs. Almost all of those populations are now endangered, and so those, you know, foraging for those eggs is no longer allowed in many cases. And that's not because it wasn't in balance once. It's that, once you get population density up to a certain level, then you do have some issues. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I do think that, you know, we can't, it's not possible to go back. So we do have to be, you know, it's not just about being sort of looking to the traditional wisdom. That's a key element, but it's also being creative and saying, okay, how are we going to go into the future in such a way that's really going to sustain the people of the world? And that, in my opinion, probably does include grain farming on a large scale. But if we're going to eat grains, then we need to process them properly. And, you know, we can't go back to being hunter-gatherers. I mean, that's not going to happen. And the one thing I wanted to say, too, about the cheap food is that the cheap food is based on cheap petroleum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the case in the 20th century, that everything in our food system, the way that we have developed it, depends on cheap oil. I was even just listening to a radio program the other day where they were interviewing a farmer in the Midwest, and, he's kind of up a creek, so to speak, because the gas prices are so high, and he has to fill up his tractors. They do a whole $150 in gas per tractor per day is what he needs on his farm. And, you know, so all of us are worrying about, you know, the gas prices for driving, but where the gas prices as they go up is really going to start to hurt us is in our food system.
Wow.
Because that's what the post-World War II, the industrial food system is based on, is cheap oil.
Mm-hmm. And then we have to drive it around the country produce it.
And we ship. It's cheaper to buy, still at this point, it's cheaper to get an apple from New Zealand than from Sebastopol.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of cheap oil. But as we begin to run out of oil, that whole equation is going to shift.
Mm-hmm.
And I really am concerned for the future in terms of, both in terms of the health of our kids, but also just in terms of how we really are going to feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way that we feed the world right now is on cheap oil. And I don't think oil's going to be cheap for too much longer.
No, it's not. Well, I want to ask you one more question before we get to the Weston A. Price, and that's the spiritual thread throughout the book. And I'd love to talk about the moons and the cycles.
Right.
And give us that.
Well, yeah, I'll just tell you how the book is organized. So the way that I've organized the book is around the traditional lunar calendar, mostly coming out of the Old Farmer's Almanac. And so it's sort of a year-long calendar in 13 moons, starting in late February with the Hunger Moon, and then the Sap Moon, which is in March, and the Egg Moon, which is the moon we're in right now in April, and going through the year that way. So the book is also sort of on another level about sort of remembering what it was like to have sort of a cyclical relationship to food that changed during the course of the year, that there was a time of year of more and a time of year of less, and there was a time of year for eggs and a time of year for maple sap and a time of year for salmon and a time of year to be preserving your, you know, making your sauerkraut,
mm-hmm.
or making your pickles to keep for the winter. And so I'm also very interested in sort of reviving that. Again, we can't go back, but remembering is, I think, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of ways we can invite in those cycles in our life. I mean, just eating locally and seasonally is a very simple one to sort of make that shift. which is, you know, pretty radical in a culture where, you know, you can go to Safeway and buy anything any mm-hmm. time of the year, and that's what most people do and don't even really have a sense of, you know, a warm day means a delicious tomato, mm-hmm. and, you know, the first thaw means the asparagus is popping up and things like that.
Yes. Well, Jessica, your book, Full Moon Feast, by Jessica Prentice, for those of you who are just joining us, you are listening to Julie Matthews on Reality Sandwich, KPOO, and we were just hearing about Jessica Prentice's new book, Full Moon Feast, Food and the Hunger for Connection. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And now we can switch gear.
Well, I just wanted to mention her website.
Oh, thank you.
Yes,
please do.
I consider an incredible resource.
It is.
Should I go ahead and...
So you might as well.
You can find... a lot about Jessica, but also a lot about the Bay Area and local resources at www.wisefoodways.com.
Thanks, Sandrine.
Thank you, Sandrine. So now let's talk about nourishing our children and the campaign that we're all part of. Obviously, so far you can tell that we feel very passionately about this way of eating and its importance for the planet and each of us for our individual health. And, of course, that starts in childhood. And so we feel it's really important to nourish our children and to bring back those principles that have worked for so long and start to nourish our children the way that they were meant to be. So Sandrine, the founder and president of Nourishing Our Children...
So when we were talking about doing this radio show, I told Julie that I wanted to talk a little bit about what motivated me, mm-hmm. what inspired me to close my practice as a learning specialist and move into the realm of a nonprofit public education campaign. And while I was serving as a learning specialist for a number of years, I noticed certain trends similar to Weston A. Price's discoveries in the mouths of his patients. I noticed that the students in my practice all had fairly narrow faces and crooked teeth. They were all braced for reconstruction. Their attention was fairly limited. They were often quite fatigued by the time they came to me after school. They didn't have a look of vitality on their faces. They had canker sores, flatulence farts, essentially, is what I'm wanting to say in a kind of diplomatic way. They didn't strike me as children with the kind of energy I remember my peers having when I was growing up. And when I was growing up, in my circle, and I come from a family of four children, so there are 9 years between us, and I don't remember from my generation all the way to my youngest brother's generation that any of our peers were going to speech pathologist or occupational specialist, occupational therapist, learning specialist, any kind of tutors. None of this was part of our lives. And amongst the students I was seeing in my full practice year-round with a waiting list, which also disturbed me, was that they were being taken from one specialist to another after a full day at a private school with small classrooms.
Mm.
So just around the time that I founded the San Francisco chapter of the Weston A. Price Foundation and more, you know, was becoming educated in these principles, I started to formulate a theory in my mind that the kids who had these various learning disabilities or diagnosed with learning disabilities were really malnourished rather than learning disabled.
Mm.
And I saw evidence of the malnourishment just looking at them, and I experienced it in teaching them. I had students whom it took years. In all honesty, I've had students who were with me for years who couldn't quite grasp the difference between ah and ow, or I and eh. And despite every remediation tool under the sun, they really struggled with that sort of processing. And so in essence, I decided that while I could, by and large, teach virtually any child to read, if they came often enough and if the stimulation was consistent enough, stimulation meaning the educational process, I wanted to focus on what I was, in my mind, conceptualizing as a foundational piece of this remediation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what they were putting in their mouths. And while I suspected that it might not cure, so to speak, or heal the issues that were manifesting,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the table I was working at, I knew that unless we went to sort of that foundational, fundamental, basic nutritional piece, unless we started there, we really wouldn't know where we would get. And so I decided that I wasn't truly a part of the solution to the degree that I wanted to be personally as a learning specialist. I wanted to educate the parents in my practice about the importance of nutrition and also the myths. Many of them mm-hmm. were parents who thought that they were feeding their kids very well
mm-hmm.
with a lot of microwavable organic foods and packaged convenience foods, all labeled as organic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, drinking soy milk, eating box cereal. Parents thought they were really already feeding their kids all the nutrients they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So this Nourishing Our Children campaign actually started in my private practice 2 years ago when I hosted Dr. Thomas Cowan to speak on two occasions to my clients.
Hmm.
And interestingly, we called those lectures Nourishing Our Children.
Nice.
And then some 2 years later, the birth of the campaign, we ended up going back to that very name. And nourishing, of course, has great connotation. It's not about feeding our children.
Mm-hmm.
And so the focus is really looking at the nutrient density of the foods we're giving the children and staying, you know, sort of demythologizing the common, I won't say even wisdom, but the common storyline or the common imperative to stay away from certain food groups, such as the saturated fats and which is, you know, butter and a lot of the foods. Actually, this brings me to the point that we had wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
There are key nutrients for brain development that we know are key.
Yes.
And there are vitamin A, vitamin D, DHA, zinc, tryptophan, cholesterol, and choline. And those nutrients are found in foods such as cod liver oil and liver and butter, liver, butter, and eggs from grass-fed animals.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica just talked about grass-fed. And, again, egg yolks, the red meat of grass-fed animals, shellfish. So these foods, the cod liver oil, the liver, butter, and egg yolks of grass-fed animals are the very foods we're told, parents are told not
mm-hmm.
to feed their children, not to feed themselves.
Exactly.
And that's where the key nutrients for brain development reside or are found.
It wouldn't be that much of a stretch then to see that your children in your practice probably weren't getting any of these foods, and probably not too surprising that their brain wasn't functioning as optimally as it might.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think really at the core of our campaign, our campaign is about giving a PowerPoint presentation to groups of parents to educate them with these timeless principles
mm-hmm.
and to explain why one need not stay away from butter or cod liver oil or egg yolks
mm-hmm.
And the nutritional value of those types of foods. And we also want to highlight the importance of eliminating certain foods from the diet, such as the ever popular cereal bowl,
mm.
cereal breakfast,
right.
You know, cold cereal box. And there was a study performed at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor in 1960 that Sally Fallon describes in her book Nourishing Tradition.
Will you yeah. read it for us?
Yeah, I'm going to read it. So 18 rats were divided into three groups. And one group received cornflakes and water. A second group was given the cardboard box that the cornflakes came in and water. And the control group received rat chow and water.
Okay.
And the rat in the control group remained in good health throughout the experiment. But the rats receiving cornflakes and water died before the rats that were given the box. The last cornflake rat died on the day the first box rat died.
Wow.
So before death, the cornflake rats developed schizophrenic behavior. They threw fits, they bit each other,
mm.
and finally went into convulsion.
Mm.
An autopsy revealed dysfunction of the pancreas, liver, and kidneys, and degeneration of the nerves in the spine, all signs of insulin shock.
Mm-hmm.
And we know about the rise of diabetes,
yes,
and childhood diabetes, and as a nutritionist, I'm sure you come
yes,
we've
talked about this a lot of times about these refined sugars and how they increase sugar levels and insulin and all that.
Okay. So the startling conclusion of this study is that there is more nourishment in the box that cold breakfast cereals come in than the cereals themselves, or at least it sustained the rats longer.
Yeah, my guess would be that the box was less toxic.
Yes.
Because you want to explain the extruder process a little bit? That might
yes.
just briefly might
yes.
help people.
Essentially, an extruder is an industrial machine that produces, you know, the O shape and the flake shape and the different puffed grains that we receive in those boxes. And it's a machine that uses high temperatures and pressures to create these grains. So there's nothing natural about it. The grains are moved through a very violent experience. And the cereal industry has convinced the FDA that extruded grains are no different than non-extruded grains. Jessica talked about properly prepared grains and soaking them so that they're more digestible, most digestible.
Mm-hmm.
These grains don't have any of those. None of that intention has mm-hmm. gone into these grains. This is a mass-produced process. And the fact of the matter is, as you can see from the study that I just mentioned, this extrusion process is certainly not safe
mm-hmm.
because the corn flakes created in these rats, suffering. And one of the questions Sally poses is that, you know, she wonders, with so many millions of children starting their day with this cold breakfast cereal and increasing numbers of them having difficulty concentrating
mm-hmm.
in school, is there a correlation?
Right.
So one of the things we highlight in the campaign is that even foods labeled as organic, like the extruded cold breakfast cereals, whether organic or not, just because something is labeled organic, above all on a box or a can, doesn't ensure its nutritional value or even its safety.
Mm-hmm.
MSG can be found in organic foods.
Mm-hmm.
Refined sugars can be found in organic foods. So, like I said, many of the parents in my practice thought that they were feeding their children very healthy foods because
right.
of the label natural, mm-hmm. or fortified, or organic. And so part of our campaign is showing that that's not necessarily a nourishing meal.
Right, right. You were telling, I had this thought, and now I forgot what the thought was. Well, I will think of it at some point, I'm sure. Processed foods. I was going to say something about processed foods.
Maybe milk is a processed food?
No. Oh, soy.
Okay.
So talking about foods that don't do so well, we're talking about processed foods. And you know, this is probably where we'll either lose a lot of vegetarians or they'll be throwing things at the radio or something. But there's a great book, The Whole Soy Story, excellent book on some of the truths about soy. And we won't go into all of them now, but one simple thing is that in traditional times when people did use soy, they did similar things to what Jessica's talking about. They fermented it. They went through special processes to inactivate certain things and activate other things within this to make it a nourishing food. They weren't eating large mass-produced protein powders and soy milks and all of that,
right.
tofu. And one of the challenges with a lot of these soy products is they're filled with MSG.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you aren't aware of that, go to your favorite, I won't even need to pick one, health food or co-op store. If you look at those artificial meat products, I would say almost all of them have MSG
mm-hmm.
in them. And I'm shocked when I go to some of these wonderful co-ops and see loads of MSG on the
mm-hmm.
shelf. Things like autolyzed yeast extract, hydrolyzed vegetable protein.
Mm-hmm.
These are all ingredients that have about 40% MSG or more. And so another food that you didn't see in the traditional diets was all of this processed soy
mm-hmm.
and all of the ingredients, the hidden ingredients that go into it. And parents probably think, oh, we heard bad things about meat and saturated fat from beef, so now let's give them a substitute of this vegetable protein and
One thing I just want to say really briefly that drives me crazy is that so many of these products are called smart such and such.
Right.
You know, like smart bacon or...
smart dogs.
Yeah, or my father-in-law eats a margarine product called Smart Balance, which I call stupid imbalance. You know, but you know, they put the smart before because, yeah, they've told people that, you know, eating the foods of our ancestors is not going to nourish them.
Mm-hmm.
And so people switch to these things actually thinking they're doing the smart thing,
right.
The wise thing, and it just really isn't.
I wanted to interject, you just mentioned that soy is often used as an alternative because folks have been told not to have saturated fats, and saturated fats and cholesterol are vital for optimal health.
Mm-hmm. And not only children's too, but adults.
Yes. And cholesterol helps babies and children develop a healthy brain and nervous system. Saturated fats provide integrity to the cell wall. They promote the body's use of essential fatty acids and enhance the immune system. They protect the liver and contribute to strong bones. And saturated fats, despite or popular belief, I guess some way I'm wanting to say that, they do not clog arteries,
mm-hmm.
nor do they cause heart disease. In fact, saturated fats are the preferred food for the heart. And we could spend an hour just on that, but I did want to highlight it on our website, nourishingourchildren.org. We do have a whole page on fats and the importance of fats, above all for a developing child.
And that's in the briefing book, correct?
Actually on the website itself.
Okay.
The page is right on the website.
Great.
Under what parents need to know. There's a whole page, we call it the skinny on fat. And one can also go and download this page from the briefing book, but there's a whole page on fat.
Great.
And the reasons why it's so important to shy away, not to shy away from fat. But when we talk about fat, we're not talking about any fat. Not
mm-hmm.
all fats are equal. We're
sure.
talking about traditional fats such as coconut oil, sesame oil, olive oil, lard, tallow, chicken fat. Not
butter.
Yes, butter. Thank you.
Ghee.
Yes, exactly. So we're not
red
talking
palm oil.
Hello, good.
Yes.
So we're not talking about
French fried food.
Right. I mean the fat that is vegetable. These vegetable oils, the safflower oils and the corn oil and the soy oil are not the traditional fats we're talking about that have the benefits we're looking for.
Right.
I just want to say one thing about the artery and heart attack issue, because that's just such a prevailing myth in our
mm-hmm.
culture that these saturated fats cause clogging of the arteries. And, you know, it's interesting to note that even in the literature, there's all of these quote-unquote paradoxes that they've discovered. It started with the French paradox. The people in the south of France eat
mm-hmm.
very, very high-fat, saturated fat diets, but don't get heart disease and don't have clogged arteries. And then they had something else that they called the Eskimo paradox. Same thing, 80% of calories came from saturated animal fats.
Blubber.
And blubber. And and yet there's no clogging of the arteries. The same thing with the Maasai paradox. The Maasai diet was almost entirely animal foods, primarily whole fat milk and blood from living animals and meat and honey. And no clogging of the arteries.
Mm.
So this is even among the scientists, they're kind of scratching their heads and saying, this lipid hypothesis, which is just a hypothesis that was proposed in the 1940s or 50s by Ansel Keys and hasn't been proven. And in fact, there's lots of evidence to disprove it. And yet it's been a very, very profitable hypothesis for the food processing industries that have convinced us that, you know, margarine is smarter than
mm-hmm.
butter, because you can make a profit on margarine and you can't make a profit, not a big one, on grass-fed butter.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
As we're coming to a close,
yes.
I just wanted to highlight, because we talked about the cereal and what do people drink cereal with, often skim milk or low-fat
mm-hmm.
milk, organic or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And we consider, milk from animals who have been in confinement to be just as processed. I mean, that pasteurized milk,
yes.
of course, is just another essential, essentially a processed food. On our website, we talk about the Got Milk campaign, and we highlight the fact that milk comes from animals who have been in confinement and fed a diet high in soy, grain, bakery waste, pesticide-laden, citrus pulp, and even pellets containing chicken manure.
Hmm.
So pesticides, antibiotics, trans fats, estrogens, and similar toxic substances can end up in that milk, organic or otherwise. So we're promoting a return to real milk,
mm-hmm.
what we call real milk, which is raw milk,
mm-hmm.
that hasn't been pasteurized or processed in that way. I mean, it's just, when I say processed, I mean denatured.
Homogenized and
exactly.
all those other things they do.
Exactly. So some folks wonder, well, what is real milk? And real milk comes from the old-fashioned cows that produce lots of butterfat, such as the Jersey and the Guernsey. And real milk comes from herds allowed to graze on green pasture. And it's full-fat milk.
Mm-hmm.
It contains no additives. It's not pasteurized or homogenized. And, in fact, in California, unlike many other states, we have raw, real milk readily available to us. I don't know how readily anymore because we're spreading the word.
Right.
We do have Claravale and Organic Pastures raw milk available to us. And if those, since we're coming to a close, those in the audience who are listening are concerned about the safety of raw milk, we have published on our website, evidence of safety, supporting the safety of raw milk, and lots of links to the Real Milk Campaign's
mm-hmm.
website. The fact of the matter, I mean, to distill it in one sentence, organic pastures that has been highly,
it's had a lot of oversight
regulation. Highly regulated.
Yeah, highly regulated, right.
Has never had one pathogen ever detected in any of the myriad of ways in which they test. You know, from the tank that holds the milk
mm-hmm.
to the cows to the
yes.
I mean, there's just
it's amazing when you
yeah.
look at the evidence on it, and just we don't have time to explain everything. But there a lot of the studies that were done that some of these hypotheses were based on were when they did saturated fat, they used hydrogenated coconut oil. Well, we know that that's bad, and the milk they were looking at whole milk, but they were looking at milk that had milk solids added back where the cholesterol was oxidized, and we know that's harmful now. So a lot of the studies that people use to back these up actually aren't accurate. From what we know now. So I think we're about out of time. I want to make sure that we can go ahead and give the campaign website.
Yes. So we're located at nourishingourchildren.org. And right now the campaign is mainly focused in three spheres. We're selling at a discount the Nourishing Traditions book that Sally Fallon has written.
Mm-hmm.
We're giving presentations in schools. Jessica just gave a presentation at the People's Grocery. So schools and other associations
mm-hmm.
giving a PowerPoint presentation. In fact, we'll be giving a presentation that's open and free to the public.
Great.
If you go to our website and look at the calendar, you can find out about it. It'll
Great.
Be next week. And then also we offer cooking classes, foundational cooking classes.
Wonderful.
So those are mainly the three spheres. If any of you listening are interested in having us come speak to your group, we have a very dynamic and creative PowerPoint that we've spent the good part of a year putting together, and it's all free of charge. So we can come to speak to you as a educational gift.
Great. So that's nourishingourchildren.org and wisefoodways.com. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Julie.
You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You are listening to Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. And listen to us on Reality Sandwich every Thursday at noon. You can reach me at healthfullivingsf.com. Thanks for listening.